Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
What up, Prep Nation? We are back. It is summer, summertime. I am Terry Foy, joined by Dan Kaplan and Dan Aber. And we have almost 2 weeks of the recruiting circuit to digest. Coach Abern, how are you holding up?
I'm doing well, Terry. We could definitely get into the specifics of some of these tournaments that we were at. So,
no doubt. Like I said, we're recording this on Thursday morning. Dan Kaplan just returned from Maverick Showtime, where he spent 2 days in Tilton Falls, New Jersey. And given that that is one of the most significant and substantial events of the summertime relative to building college coach consensus, we are going to start there, and then we are going to typewriter back all the way to what is effectively the beginning, where Matt Kinnear was on site at Adrenaline Black Card, and then Dan, you and I were there for Platinum Cup on that Saturday, Sunday. A tremendous event. Got a lot of notes coming away from that. We've actually already published that report, so you can go check that out. And then after that, you hit up First Class Lacrosse's Best in Class 2026s, which is another one of those really substantial individual showcases. Got eyes on a lot of really talented players. So we're going to talk about that. Concurrent with that, I headed to Newport, Rhode Island, where ML8 was hosting its High School Summer National Championship, which is, it was 14 high school teams, kind of treating it in a different way, coming off of the end of their 2024 season, but got eyes on a handful of really notable players. So we'll briefly touch on that. And then we're going to end by talking about last weekend, where Dan Aburn, you and I rotated between Primetime Invitational and Grade 8. I was at Primetime on Saturday and Grade 8 on Sunday. You were the opposite. So that is the agenda for today. So, Coach Kaplan, what were your takeaways high level from Maverick Showtime before we dive into some of the specific player standouts and performances?
Yeah, this was the first time it felt like for me I've seen and heard a lot about so many of the guys that were in this event. And it was a lot of piecing their games to what I've heard and talked about with them or seen from their highlight tapes and then actually seeing that, you know, applied in 6-on-6 settings or full field settings and, you know, with competition on the line and, you know, a situation where everybody is, you know, really, really strong. So there's no easy matchups, anything like that. So it was, for me, really, really valuable from that, like starting to match some faces to names and start to really understand their games beyond just highlight tapes or the hearsay of a lot of them. So I feel like that was probably the most valuable aspect of it. And then beyond that, like, gosh, if you were a player in that 2026 class at this event, like, there was no better exposure. Every inch of both sidelines was completely loaded. So to your point about it being really influential in terms of forming college consensus, there's no doubt that that, you know, was definitely happening over the course of that 76 hours.
Yeah, and Kaplan, I got texts here and there about how good the 27 class was at this event. Can you divulge a little bit more about what you saw from that?
Definitely. Yeah, so I really only watched the 2027 All-Star game personally. Coach Wilhelm was all over that and then got to watch the 25s on Wednesday while they had their larger stretch of games. But the All-Star game specifically was just absolutely loaded. It felt like every offensive player was a level of skilled that like they would have just fit right in with the 2026s. They're just a smaller version. There was a few standout, you know, highlight performances coming from that we'll kind of dive into a bit when we get into some of the player specifics. But yeah, another really just, I'd say, important event there for the 2027s in terms of kind of starting to make a name for themselves. And, you know, obviously there's no contact at this point, but there were certainly coaches there starting to, you know, take their analysis and form their opinions of who they're going to want to go target, you know, this time a year from now.
So generally speaking, this podcast is going to focus on, and by this podcast, I'm referring to the Preps podcast over the course of the remainder of the summer, focus on the class of 26. It is the recruitable age group right now where so many college coaches' eyes are and where the decisions that are going to be made in August that inform how recruitment unfolds in September are being formed. But with that being said, we will peek in at the classes of 25 and 27 and share some high-level observations as they arise. But Dan, let's get into those player specifics. I know that you have what is effectively a all-tournament team coming away from this. Do you want to run through the attack and midfield, and then we can follow up with some specifics about those guys?
Yeah, that's perfect. And so that's the beauty of traveling with a partner is we got to jump in the car and kind of just start throwing out all of our thoughts. And ultimately what we ended up doing is creating a pair of all tournament or all event teams for the 26 and 27 class as a means of kind of highlighting standouts by position. And so the 2026 group that I settled on at attack, and gosh, it like I said, this was a ton of fun because it was really hard, right? Like we got to sit there and argue for 3 hours on our way home. So what we landed on was Hanson Peck, Brady Mullet, and Cooper Brozek as our first team Showtime attack. And then at midfield, we had Dylan Faison, Skane, I have to double check on his first name, I'm forgetting off the top of my head. And then we had Gillis as the last member of that first team midfield. We did go ahead and do a second team because, like we said, there was lots of really impressive players to go ahead and pick from. On our second, we ended up settling on John Balsamo, Tim Plunkett, and James Cameron. And this leads to another little bit of a sneak peek into one of the segments to come, and that's our All-Star Game snubs. So I'm excited to kind of dive in on some of those, too. Hitting midfield, though, we have Chris Dochna, Adam Ponting, and Rick Giordano leveling out our second team midfield of the Showtime. So that's our offensive group. Go ahead. Questions. Fire away.
I mean, so just hearing a lot of those names, those are some of the names that I found were to be also impressive at some of the events that I was at this weekend. Who amongst that group do you think really caught either your eye, Dan, or perhaps some of the coaches that you're in the near vicinity of?
So definitely, I mean, all of them, but the one that kind of shot up the radar the most, meaning like I entered my first couple of games not knowing a whole ton about him and then left there like, oh my gosh, this kid is incredible. If I was any offensive coordinator in the country, I'd be like not hammering his door down. And that's Cooper Brozek. I thought he was incredible. Left-handed attackman that plays with a ton of just like skill and slickness to him, but he can really go at you and attack matchups. The highlight to me that sticks out to him is he kind of splits to his right and goes as if he's going to take one of those backhands coming up the hash with his left hand up the right hash. And the defender does a really good job of kind of closing that out. And he has to close it out so hard, though, that Brozek just turns over his other shoulder. And it's kind of a question mark, kind of a exclamation point, kind of just like getting up to the hash and turning over your opposite shoulder and shooting it. But he just does it so smooth and so polished. And it was all set up so well, by the way, that he turned the corner as if he was going to bury the backhand. And I think it was all just kind of set up like, you know, if you give me that, I'm going to take it. I'm going to bury it. And if you take it away, it's still ending up in the back of the net. And then he does all of the stuff that you would expect as like an off-ball left-handed attackman, moving off-ball, cutting and scraping the backpipe and finishing everything inside.
So I got an opportunity to see Brozek on Sunday when he was playing with 3D New England at grade 8 and came away with a similar but kind of different impression where I felt like the space that he occupied on the field put him in a position where I could imagine him playing midfield. And so I've had two conversations about him since with, you know, high-level coaches. One kind of isolated him and Ponting as at this point, the two best Canadians in the class, at least in terms of the way that, you know, it's kind of thought about and considered. And part of that comes from the fact that Brozek's at Deerfield and Ponting's at Lawrenceville. So there are maybe fewer question marks from an academic standpoint that sometimes can arise. And so, you know, the guys that are simply playing juniors and don't have as much exposure to the field game and field lacrosse coaches, you know, maybe there are some better players that fit into that category that just haven't popped on the radar yet. But for time being, that was interesting. And then the second conversation was comparing him to Dyson Williams, which I really liked primarily because of that ability to maybe play midfield And then also because of his ability to attack matchups, which you talked about. So definitely a player whose profile, I think, has increased a decent amount over the course of the last week or so, at least in terms of the inside lacrosse perspective. Shifting gears, one of the things that is always kind of the tenor for the summer, and I've spoken about this previously insofar as, you know, for a successive run of years, and at the very least, the class of 19 through the class of 23... Actually, really 22, and I'll get to this point in a second. There was a relatively clear consensus number one recruit in the class heading into the summer, right? So from Connor Schellenberger to Brennan O'Neill to Andrew McAdory to Joey Spallina. And it helped frame the consciousness around who the best players were, because if that is the consensus number one player, then I can compare all these other players against him and figure out what the gap is, and right? And so, you know, I know what a 2 to 3% gap looks like, and I know where that falls relative to the rankings. The summer of 23, I thought, was affected by the fact that McCabe Millen was entering the summer very clearly the consensus number one ranked player, but he didn't play that summer because of injury. And so there was this little thing that happened in terms of the ability to compare against him the way that kind of unfolded. And then similarly with the class of 24 and Ryan Dunkel, who not only didn't play because of injury, but also because of the I don't think was as firm or solid as a number one ranked player, that, you know, it kind of impacted the way in which the entire class was viewed and thought about. Similarly with 25, you know, not nearly as strong of a consensus in terms of who the number one player was at the beginning of the summer. And now for these 26s, what's interesting is, you know, as I've had these conversations about who the best player is, one guy that is routinely left out, despite the fact that he belongs in it, is Dylan Faison. And I think the reason is because he's already committed to Notre Dame. He was able to do so because he is a football player, and there are no limitations on when you can talk to prospects the way that there are in lacrosse. So he committed to play lacrosse effectively on the assumption that he would be able to, and, you know, without having had contact with the staff, except through the fact that his brother is currently on the team. So obviously he's able to have some measure of contact just because, you know, you're allowed to talk to the families of the players that are on your team, not about recruiting, but about other stuff. So he knows that he's going to be admitted. He knows that he's going to have a full scholarship by a football. And now he just needs to wait and get confirmation that he's going to have an opportunity to play lacrosse, should that be allowed for him. Dan, how do you feel about his performance at Showtime? And how do you feel about what he represents to the group overall, just as a symbol?
Yeah, I mean, he is incredible. I think what sets him apart is, like, just a burst in athleticism, change of speed that is basically unmatchable. But what differentiates him a little bit from his brother is he's much more of, like, a square you up, bounce around, he can invert, take you behind. And ultimately, I think his versatility, his athleticism, like, definitely puts him in that number one conversation. I think he played yesterday like he wanted to secure that right in front of Coach Corrigan, who was on the sidelines. And yeah, I think he's certainly a symbol. He's certainly one that, as every midfielder goes and sees, like, they even internally are probably comparing themselves against him a bit. And it's starting to get to the point where, like, every time he touches the ball, like, every player on the field starts to recognize, like, okay, like, we're going to have to slide here regardless of who's on the cover, and we're going to have to be buttoned up because he's a really good feeder too. And so it's pretty incredible. I would certainly say that he's a leading symbol and leading player in that discussion, and it made a really strong case again this week.
And if he's anything as close to as good as his brother, like, we can expect him to be, I would say, top 5, top 10 player at the least, but definitely in the conversation for number one.
And he's different. He's a different player than his brother. I think he's unique. You know, his brother, obviously, we saw firsthand, you know, playing and doing a ton of really good things for that Notre Dame offense, but it was a lot of downhill dodge, you know, start up high, start out of the box, get ahead of steam. He's pretty good on the wing, getting to, like, an infield, upfield shoulder, but that isn't necessarily what I would describe as his game. Dylan, I thought, was incredible out of an invert. every time he had a short stick, he would kind of go and work below GLE. And the way that he was able to manipulate the defense with like one, two hard steps, start to get them to slide, pull up, be a feeder, stop the slide, jab the other way, and like get the slide off base just to kind of come back, and doing it all with his head up so he can make any defense pay if they do decide to come. It was pretty incredible. The ball did die in his stick a bit because of it, but I think that's just a virtue of all of these types of events where it's like, there's a sideline of coaches here. I'm trying to learn myself, you know, a scholarship here, and we don't have an offense. Like, we haven't practiced for more than 30 minutes together or whatever. So, like, I'm going to make something special happen here. And guess what? I can make something special here.
Let's transition to the other end of the field. Who were your first, and if you've got them, second team faceoff guys, short sticks, long sticks, defenders, and goalie?
All right, so I didn't go full second team for the other side of the ball or specialties, but I have plenty of shout-outs to give, so maybe not establishing a pecking order, but we'll mention plenty of names there. Defensively, that's where I'll start just because I want to. One name that I know you're going to like hearing, Joe Legas, Flint Leverett, and Carter Martin are the guys that I really, really liked. I really enjoyed all of those guys. Were all-star game selections as well. Carter Martin is where I'll start, out of North Carolina. Really impressive, like, physically. He immediately popped the first time I sat down on the field. Like, 45 seconds later, there's a ground ball maybe 10 yards ahead of me right at GLE. And I think a lot of kids would have gone and, you know, gone for one of those gooses and try and pick it up themselves on the other side, or, you know, a lot of, you know, would have gone about it with something slick. And he just puts his shoulder straight into the attackman that was closest to it, stops him in his track, boxes out, full clean ground ball. And it was just one of those things that it's like, okay, like, that'll draw your eyes. And then for the rest of it, you just rarely saw him make any type of mistakes. He does a good job of kind of sensing when, like, his adjacent defenders would start to rotate and covering up space. And then he's really good on the ball. And so he was one, and to your point of a guy that maybe I didn't know a ton about, but then kind of bursted onto the radar for me, he was one that I would put into that category as well. Flint Leverett, Culver Academy defender, plays a little bit of the LSM, can play down at close. He might be the best off-ball defender in this class that I've seen so far. His talk and polish and just, like, his ability to read the demeanor of the Dodger to understand, like, okay, I need to go here and need to get there with urgency, or I can jab at it once or twice and let him bounce to go be a feeder and then recover, so now we don't have to actually, like, go all the way and rotate and, you know, give a whole bunch of offense because we slid to something that maybe we didn't need to, maybe something that we could have just jabbed at and made the Dodger, you know, start to bail. And then Joe Legas, I think, might just be the best all-around of everything that we talked about. Really good communicator, really high IQ. He talks in the clear. He's got a good stick. He understands all the spacing that's involved in that. And I think that's one thing. Like, we mentioned offenses in solo situations, a lot of ISO-type stuff. I think one thing that falters in these events sometimes is, like, if you struggle in the clear, you just end up having the ball jammed back down your throat time and time and time again. And sometimes you just need a little organization in the clear to get it, but it's hard to do in these individual settings. And I think that in this, like, it's really clear when you have defenders on the field that understand the spacing, go to it correctly, communicate what they're supposed to, and get out, you know. And he's one that did that well and does all that type of stuff. But then in six-on-six sets and does in six-on-six sets and on the ball and all that type of stuff, he is really, really sensational. He's patient, I think, is the way that I would ultimately describe him. He doesn't go and try and do too much. He hunkers down. He plays great position defense. I think he's really smart, right? I've mentioned that a couple times and talking. Like, he really quickly started to pick up on tendencies. I mentioned Faison and the inverts. The one person that I saw blow it up was Joe Legas, who just sensed an opportunity to quickly switch it, get on ball, and then did a good job on the cover as well. So,
Ligas is a tremendous example of how when you don't know the class in total, you can fall in love with a player and not know where he sits in. But I think that experience gives you a greater confidence in how you feel about where this kid is relative to the ceiling. And so I watched him last summer at our event. He was playing for Advance, and you know, he had gotten kind of, I was just told by somebody who I trust, like, hey, keep an eye on this kid. You're really going to like him. And a lot of what you just said, jumped out. But one thing you didn't say, and this is a personal preference that for me is far and away the overriding attribute to his game, is, So he's 6'3", he plays hockey. Those skills manifest in being great off the ground. You talked about sticks and passing lanes, and I think that's another huge aspect of his game. So the way I have framed it over the course of the last, because I saw him again in the winter, fall, you know, fall, winter, and then obviously already a couple times this summer, is I think he's the best, very clearly the best number two defenseman in the class, and you know, potentially at the next level. In some ways, I would you know, kind of compare him to Cole Kastner. Obviously, he's 4 inches shorter, but a lot of the things that Kastner did so well are the things that Ligas does really well. The point I'm getting at is that he is a possession killer, meaning that I wouldn't want him to be Cade Sostad, mark the number one opponent, and then lose all of the other things that he can do because he's guarding the opposing team's number one player, and you have to be solely focused on that. I would want him to be on the second best offensive player. He can win that matchup consistently, but he's not going to be in the action nearly as frequently as he would if he were guarding the number one. And so as a result, his ability to blindside double, his ability to pick up ground balls, and then far and away, the number one skill, in my opinion, is once you have the ground ball, and you talked about the benefits in the clearing game. I think a lot of times when people think about that, they think about it from second 3 to second 15 after you got the ball. He is so good in seconds 1 and 2, not immediately giving the ball back to the offense. That is, in a shot clock era, to me, the most underrated skill for a defender, because there is no play that is more damaging than appearing to get a stop, seeing your defense start to get into their clear, and then succumbing to the Pat Kavanaugh, Chris Kavanaugh pressure, putting the ball back on the ground, and now you have an unsettled offensive situation that is going to be extraordinarily efficient from an offensive standpoint. I think Joe Ligas is a really safe bet to not yield those types of plays very frequently at the next level.
Love it. Totally agree.
Goalies.
Yeah, goalies.
Goalies. I have 4 of them. I mentioned that I had grievances on snubs for All-Stars, which isn't really true. I just think it's fun as a podcast segment. but I think they nailed the goalies. The 4 goalies that they picked for the All-Star game, in my eyes, were the 4 best goalies there. Number one of them would be Hunter Mezzatesta. Gabe James, I thought, was incredible. He had a really, really good day 2 later in the day. They played 3 different sessions of games. His 3rd session of the day on day 2 was one of the best goalie performances I've seen of the summer. And I think that's probably was a big piece of his boost into the All-Star game was that game. He was spectacular. I had Dylan Penn. It was excellent. Blake O'Callaghan has now been excellent at 2 events in a row. I think ultimately his game, like, I think he's really steady. I think a lot of coaches who have already evaluated him are now evaluating him as every time I see him, he's done the exact same thing. And that in itself is a huge attribute, especially in, you know, this type of gauntlet where it's wave pool of event in the tot and, you know, goalies see a ton of shots. And so to be able to kind of consistently stack really good days on top of each other, I think is part of the game there for the goalie position. And then the final is Cam Lydon out of New Canaan, who was another guy that just had a really good event, came in with kind of right on par with some of the other goalies in the class, I would think, and then kind of separated himself a little bit over the last 76 hours.
I was going to say, we know you're not an opinionated person, but let's dig into some of those snubs that you've got for us.
All right. So I think one way to think of it, we already went through Well, you're jumping the gun a little bit. I got to talk about LSMs. You're throwing me off there, Dayburn.
Oh, man.
LSMs. Jackson Allen was excellent. Really good day. Again, very, like, I sat down for one of those games, and it was off the very first faceoff. He scored a goal. And then, you know, obviously, like, those are impressionable as LSMs, but it's not the full story. And then at some point, I remember making a remark to my side of he was now below GLE, getting tested by one of the better Dodgers in the event, and did a really good job on it, on the cover of something below GLE, which is, you know, for an LSM, can be a fish out of water sometimes. And I thought his footwork on ball there was excellent, and obviously above the goal is right on par as well.
So before you move on from him, I wrote this up for something to post on Wednesday about that ML8 event. He guarded Brock Geraci a lot in the championship game of that event and held up around the goalposts really well. He was the defensive MVP of that event, and I thought he was awesome. And he's another guy who's been on my radar for a year, basically, and it's vindicating to see him come to this level of profile.
It's great, and I don't love doing the whole player comparison thing because, like, everybody is their own unique player, but in the world of that we're currently living in where Jake Paisano is so in the spotlight, we would be remiss not to at least say that their games are similar.
Well, so I was watching him on Sunday sitting next to Nick Grill, who is an assistant coach at Harvard, and obviously, you know, we're not allowed to talk about committed, like, this isn't something he said to me, this is something I said to him. I was like, hey man, I apologize, like, every defender who's 5'8 or shorter is going to get compared to a grill, but I just compared Jackson Allen to you, so, you know.
Yep. Makes sense. Another LSM to mention, Reese Piontek. I thought he was a guy that was all over the place. His team had one less defender, and you just never would have noticed from the way that he was playing. His motor was incredible. Really, really impressed by him. Great on the ball. I think, again, we mentioned, like, the world of LSMs where that's just like, can you push transition? Can you pick up the balls? Can you play on the wings? Can you be disruptive? And he can do all that stuff, sure, but there's going to be very few midfielders beating him off the dodge this summer.
Short sticks and face-off guys, and then we'll wrap it up on Maverick.
Perfect. And I, again, had to be a little bit unique. I didn't do any specific short stick D-mids because I don't want to put anybody in that box, but I do have two players highlighted that I thought were particularly impressive, either defensively or in the middle of the lines or a combination of the two. And that is Matt Colella out of Brunswick High School, who also played a ton for them, had a really good spring season. I think he's bursting up radars. I think he's going to be a guy that, you know, is garnering plenty of attention at the end of the summer. And then Parker Prater out of Culver, another guy that was just effective all over the field. He had a goal where he catches the ball, like, down at his ankles and sticks it. But again, that was in transition and coming off of playing some solid defense, which he has done very consistently. And so I think I'd shout those two guys out in those roles. And then face-off guys, again, I have another one that was someone who I didn't really have a ton of feel for. I think my favorite of the group is AJ Young, New Hampshire Tomahawks kid. But the guy that I would shout out here is Gavin Gartner from Mount Perrin High School. And again, it's just he was got someone that maybe I didn't know a ton about that had a really, really impressive week. And he was a All-Star Game selection as well. All right. You ready for my snubs, Dan?
I am.
All right. Defensively, I got four of them. Michael Mannarino was excellent. Had a really good week if he was in the All-Star. And again, snubs means I'd have to take somebody off of the list, which I'm not going to do. But just also, if they were on, nobody would have had any issues with it, I don't think. Trey Parrott, I thought he had an incredible event. Really, really impressed with him, both on ball, off ball, his stick, his, like, work in pushing and creating transition with good headman passes. Like, I just thought his game was really, really well displayed. And then Cooper Helig, who is a LaSalle College High School defender, another one that, you know, got some varsity time this year and is, you know, going to be in a position to kind of really start to run with things in the spring and is already having a really good summer. And then the final on this side of the ball, Wyatt Stams, an LSM from Lawrenceville School, thought he was incredible, left-handed, all over the field, really good off the ground, pushing transition. He will have some big springs ahead of him in that Lawrenceville system with the way that he plays.
How about the other end of the field?
So Colby Rossetti, another Lawrenceville kid, he's actually transferring from Santa Fe Christian out in California. So he will be new to Lawrenceville, but is a name to know and to, you know, put some stock in, knowing that he's going to be continuing to improve. His handle is phenomenal. Right-handed rudder Garnsey. Really, really impressed. Every time he catches it, it's hands deep to a hitch or a toe drag. And, you know, he scores some pretty phenomenal goals. By the end of the summer, he's going to have an awesome highlight tape. Cole Carberry, big body attackman. I was impressed with his game. He uses his frame exactly how you would want somebody that has that build. And he's good around the cage, good hands, but also like very capable as a dodger. And like I said, a big body that'll give some defenders plenty of trouble. That's where I'll end it.
All right, then Abern, it's on to you. You get to ask us about Platinum Cup.
Yeah, so Platinum Cup last weekend. Would love to hear your guys' takeaways from that event and, you know, particular players, especially if you've seen players that, as Kat mentioned earlier, you know, showed some consistency from event to event. Somebody that you kept eyeing and they kept performing really well. So, Terry, we'll start with you. Kaplan's talked a lot on this pod so far, so...
I have the perfect answer for that question, though.
But yeah, Terry, give me your takeaways first. Any players that you want to highlight or performances that you want to talk about?
Sure. Well, so to start, it was the first performance that I saw of the day. I was watching Team Carolina versus Alexachusetts, and the faceoff guy for Team Carolina out of Huff in North Carolina, Alex Gregoloff, come to find out he is one of the more highly regarded faceoff guys in this class. I thought he showcased a combination of impressive size, speed once he got to his feet. He was incredibly fast, whether it was reaction, hand speed, timing the whistle. I can't say, I'm not quite at that level, but he was going against quality competition. And the element that I would want to see more is how agile is he when he doesn't win forward? Because when he got into 50-50 ground ball situations, I thought there, you know, his edge, his dominance was a little bit less than it was when he was able to win forward. One of the reasons that I was on that field is because I really wanted to see, you know, that attack unit, which is really highly regarded and discussed. Tuck Gilbane was a player who put up a tremendous amount of points as a freshman at Noble and Gruneau 2 years ago. He was vaulted into a more substantial role this year. His production wasn't quite at that level. He's a really high-level hockey player who's still playing hockey. So, you know, he's going to choose to focus on lacrosse at the next level. And when he does, you can imagine his rate of production or rate of improvement increasing. But he definitely, you can tell, has a lot of experience in big games as a result of what he's been able to do playing hockey. And what I came away most impressed by was a combination of his stature and athleticism. I thought he was really thick, really balanced, really, you could tell he was well coached insofar as, you know, consistently in a triple threat position. And in that way, hard to differentiate him from Teddy Fasoli, who is another one of those Massachusetts attackmen who is really highly thought of and will get a lot of looks and opportunities at the next level. So I got an opportunity. I don't want to jump ahead, but saw them again at the Primetime Invitational and actually came away as or more impressed by Ty Curry, a lefty on that line, as I was with those two guys the week prior. So that was definitely one element. And then I would say, you know, just kind of continuing on, the next impression that came away most strongly was James Gillis. He was playing midfield for that Long Island Express Channing team. But, you know, he can be an attackman as well. He's a lefty. And Dan, I know you're going to have a lot to say about him. You already mentioned him as, all tournament team selection from Maverick. For me, he is in the conversation for the number one player in the class. And it has to do with a combination of how smooth he is athletically, how composed he is as a decision maker, and how precise he is in delivering the ball. There was one sequence where he dodged, you know, not really from X, more so like behind GLE lefty, got to 7-7, let's say, took pressure in a way that, you know, I'm not going to compare him to Joey Spallina or Lyle Thompson, but absorbed pressure, surveyed the field, and then just saw this really well-timed cut and delivered the perfect pass on the ear of a right-handed shooter who was able to finish high to high. And then very next possession comes last out of the box and dodges down the lefty alley and just delivers an absolute rocket on the run that was perfectly placed into the corner. And not to say this is an overreaction to a short sequence of plays, I thought that sequence was illustrative of his game overall. So those four guys were the players that I left that event with the strongest impressions about. But Dan was there on championship day, so he probably got an even better perspective on, you know, some of those performances.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just start right with him again. I thought he's really skilled and talented, and what you don't expect from him is like his level of hustle and heart and like commitment to getting in the hole on those hot days and long. It's like he's the most skilled player on the field, but he's also like playing with the most energy and heart and hustle and like commitment to helping his team win. And I think that alone like just helped me to fall in love with his game more.
Which is interesting because I think the biggest criticism when folks watch him is that it looks like he's casual, right? So that casualness can be interpreted for a lack of interest or something along those lines. And yeah, but it definitely belies the intensity that you're talking about that actually manifests in how they play.
Yeah, and I think like your point is that he's super composed. It's hard to be super composed and like panicking, and like, you know, that just his even keeledness helps feed that composure that you're referencing. To answer Dan's question about somebody who I, you know, stacking days, John Balsamo's points to turnover ratio this summer is unbelievable. He's 1,000 points. I've seen him turn it over maybe once, and it was like a feed inside that was a good like risk to take, you know, like, he's just been really just so steady. Every time the ball goes into his stick, it's a good decision that comes after it. And he shoots at a really high efficiency rate. So I think he's one that I would say is just stacking really good day after really good day on this summer so far.
He's an interesting player, obviously the younger brother of Charles Balsamo, who just transferred from Duke to Virginia. My impression of him was he's a quarterback from the righty wing, which it's not to say that there isn't a precedent for that. We've definitely seen it, but there aren't a ton. And, you know, I don't think he's going to scare defenses athletically in the same way that I don't think Charles scares defenses athletically, but I do think that he will be productive because of a combination of his stick skills, which manifest in an ability to absorb pressure, and then with his decision making that you talked about. Dan, what were the championship games like at Platinum Cup?
They were intense. The 26s, it was pretty one-sided. But I would say
Chaney coming away with the 10-2 win over Massachusetts. Correct. A game that people had been really excited to see,
including myself. And the score, like, it goes down as 10-2, but it didn't feel that way because even like every possession, Massachusetts, it's still, you know, going at it and going hard, and they're playing hard in the middle of the field. It just didn't manifest into goals, and that's because they play good defense and have good goalie play, and Massachusetts just didn't shoot it great. And sometimes I feel like that happens in some of those summer days. You don't end up with a whole bunch of dunks. It's shots on the run or it's shots from range, and they just don't fall for you. And I thought that kind of happened. But again, you mentioned some of those Massachusetts guys, Frisoli and Gilbane. I thought that they have so much like chemistry within them on that attack. They do a lot of kind of just like attack-based plays where the midfielders are high and floating, and it does a really good job of putting them in a position to kind of display what makes them special. And I thought all of that was impressive. I just Express was just so dominant in the middle of the field and created some in transition, and James Gillis had himself a day.
Sounds great. Cap, we also know you were at Best in Class this week. Let's dive into that a little bit. this is, you know, Best in Class has really quickly become one of the signature events of the early summer, I think, in particular. Deemer does a great job. He brings in a ton of really great, both either coaches who are in college right now playing or guys who just recently graduated. So I think that's one of the more unique events in the sense that these kids get to meet the players that they're trying to be in 1 to 2 years time.
Well, it disarms
and learn from them. Yeah.
It disarms them a bit. It lowers their guard. They don't feel like they are in this situation where they need to be showcasing. It's how can I get better and then happen to get recruited while getting better, I think is the element that they've kind of created with that. And to your point, like, it's also guys, a lot of them that went and played at these events that now are on this side of coaching it. So, like, they certainly get the feeling that those guys are having right now as they go through this, and especially for the 26s where it's such an important time.
Yeah, but let's get into it. Tell us about Best in Class, some of the players that you really came away impressed with, and any other observations from a high level that you have about this event.
And so that's kind of where I'll start, is they do some of the like small-sided stuff and 4-on-3s and 3-on-2s and all that type of stuff to kind of get things going. And it leads to better games in the afternoon. Like, they're just warmed up. They're already in this frame of team-based decision-making that then when they go into 6-on-6, like, just manifests. And I thought that one guy that – and he's the one that now you could call him a BIC vet. He's been written up twice from this, and that's Hunter Thompson, a left-handed attackman from Holderness that plays for Four Leaf. He pops in those types of things so much more than he might – over the course of, you know, a 3 to 6 game tournament, because of all of what we were just saying. Like, he's so good with hands free. He's so good in those types of things that he really, really pops all the time there. And then you get him on the radar. He's on the brain because of it. And then you're watching him in game action, and it's like, gosh, he never stops moving. He's either on the perimeter timing up a great swing cut. He's either inside and fading or inside and scraping the back pipe, but he's always working in that kind of like lefty triangle over there. And then what separates him is if he ever gets a short stick on him, he like is very confident and capable as a dodger, squaring up and either just taking top side, using his frame and shooting off hips, or getting underneath and like just beating him. He's got a little bit of a burst to him that I think coaches are going to love. They're going to see a lefty shooter finisher that you can't short stick and start to fall in love with him the way that I did.
Dan, we are 50...
Am I allowed to say that, Terry? Am I allowed to say that I love these kids?
I mean, that's a you question. Okay. It's whether... Yeah, I mean...
I'll allow myself if you don't think it's aligned
weird,
too far.
Weird? Creepy?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that you hear it in recruiting all the time. So, no, I think that you're just...
Perfect.
You're you know, leaning into your predisposition, your nature as an actual college recruiter. I don't know that love is a term that I use.
If I get to take any kid, I don't have any scholarship amount of I have no scholarship restrictions, nothing, just a blank slate.
It is irresponsible for us to be 50 minutes in and not have said the name Lucas Garcia yet.
That's probably true.
He is another one like James Gillis, who's in that, and Dylan Faison, who's in that conversation for the top ranked player in the class. He popped for me at our IDX event last fall, and you know I've been kind of tracking him since. And he was your highest evaluated player at this event. What did Lucas Garcia show you at Best in Class?
We've said the two words decision making a ton. I think it's important to talk about that more and more so that, you know, in theory, it's not just old dudes listening to this, but hopefully some kids and younger guys are listening to this and they hear the emphasis that we put on team play and being a part of 6-on-6 offense and being, a leader in terms of keeping the ball moving and playing a brand of lacrosse in club in summer that is similar to what you see in the spring on colleges. And I think that's what he does most is like, again, we mentioned like points to turnover ratio and just like being a really polished decision maker, and all of that is important. But that part, you know, a lot of people can do. Can you do that while also being two-handed? Can you do that while also being able to run by a pole that's in front of you, any short stick that's in front of you? You know, can you make those decisions at a faster pace, right? Like some teams are going to be a little bit better than what you're used to, or defenders are going to be in your hands quicker than what you're used to, and now you're sped up. And consistently, every time he gets tasked with one of those questions or tests, he just like exceeds it with all expectations. And then for me personally, and this is getting away from best in class, but you mentioned your Lucas Garcia moment. Mine was in the spring with Dan Aburn. We went and caught that Lawrenceville-Brunswick game, and it's a really tight game. And what do? They give the ball to the sophomore. He runs down the alley and kisses the ball off the far pipe and into the goal in a really, really big moment. And so I think he's consistently shown it. He's consistently proved, you know, a variety of being able to do things all over the field from attack or midfield. And he definitely doesn't box himself in as an attackman. He's like coming back in the clear when he's asked to be a midfielder. It's not like he's just coming through the box and going and playing 6-on-6. Like his versatility, his speed, his decision making, his ability to play with his head up, he's just extremely polished to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's always felt like he's playing at a much faster pace than the other kids at his age level, or his grade level. You know, it's like that term, the game slows down for them. It looks like the game is already slowing down for him as a 2026. And yeah, he's just like the complete package, really. And I think that's why he was so early to shoot up a lot of evaluators' lists. A lot of evaluators quickly realized that this kid was going to be one of the top coveted players in this class. And I have not yet seen him play. Like, obviously, you mentioned that you saw him play in the spring, but I haven't seen him play that yet this summer. But he's definitely one of those guys where it's like, yeah, like I want to go see this guy play because he's incredible. He's fun to watch. So I'm looking forward to that Lucas Garcia moment of the summer, my first one so far. It'll happen eventually.
You chime in on Twitter when it does. You let us know. My Lucas Garcia moment, : All right, more Cap. BIC talk.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, we've gone heavy, I think, it's overall in this podcast on attack midfield.
Yeah,
I think another thing that BIC does really well is they do goalie specific training. So if you could delve into some of the goalies that you thought were really impressive at this event, and then maybe some of the defenders. And I know you don't want to box guys into SSDMs, but, you know, maybe guys who were really impressive in the middle of the field as well.
So here I will box them in because I didn't actually do the boxing. It was already predetermined and they were listed on the roster, short stick D mid. And furthermore, like you can tell by the way they play that they definitely identify that way. That's Connor Sayer, Mad Dog, True Illinois player. Out of Loyola Academy, and the first time you guys see him, you will immediately realize who I'm talking about for his size. He's the biggest short stick D mid I've ever seen. He has close defense size and height and communication, but in a short stick. And he's pretty athletic on top of it. So I think he's one that will definitely pop for you guys when you get eyes on him. And then one that is a little less known, Perkiomen Valley High School. He's a Team 10 player. And Patrick Maloney is he's awesome.
He's so good.
Oh, you know.
He's so goddamn good. Perfect. I know him. Yeah, yeah. Awesome. I saw him on Sunday and I was like, if this kid's not the best short stick in the class, I'll be shocked.
He's incredible. The way that he throws hooks and he plays that short stick D mid position, the way that you know, you see on Saturdays and Sundays in the PLL, not just in college lacrosse. Like, he throws these disruptive checks, and he gets out and crowds Dodgers. And you have to have a certain level of confidence to be able to go out and step out and go play dudes that you know are pretty good at this game 60 yards away from your goal, and then absolutely just, like, match feet and completely deny them from where they're trying to get to. Like, that takes a ton of confidence, athleticism, and he really like stood out to me for all of that.
All right. You guys want to ask me about high school summer national championship?
Yeah, Terry, let's dive into that. Tell us, I mean, first of all, Newport, Rhode Island is just like gorgeous. You know, I've been to some weddings there. I can imagine going there for a lacrosse tournament. Just like the setting there just looks so serene. But apparently there was some really great lacrosse to witness as well. So let's dive into that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, for sure. So like I said at the top, some of these programs dealt or treated the event a little differently from others. So for instance, Cushing Academy brought their graduated seniors. So got an opportunity to see two guys that have been on our radar for a long time. Attackman Stone Evans going to Providence and goalie Daniel Domenconi. I'm going to struggle it, but he's going to Towson. And the thing that I really noticed about him was how similar how much he reminded me of Mike Gianfercaro in a combination of the energy that he plays with when he's in the goal, as well as how ready he is to come out of the goal at the first opportunity. And the sweatpants helped as well. There was a little bit of power suggestion. You know, Stone Evans let's shift gears and say that. So Salisbury won. It was a 14-team event. It featured a playoff bracket, so to speak, in terms of having pool play into semifinals and then the semifinals yielding a championship. So the four teams that qualified for the semifinals were Governor's Academy, who beat New Hampton in the semifinal round, and then Salisbury beat St. Andrews from Florida in what was going to be one of the most anticipated games of the event, and certainly lived up to the billing as well. And then Governors won this event last year, so Salisbury got their revenge, which I think was really important. You know, this was a team that had a disappointing season, finishing 7-9. They lost 8 of their last 9 games, but they were really young. And you know, they've got stars in terms of Cam Kelly, Chris Alexis, and the guy who I think has seen his stock rise the most over the course of the spring in Parker Reynolds. So we'll get to that in a little bit, but I do think that, you know, at the risk of kind of being a little reductive, I came away with similar impressions of Evans as I did with Kelly, because they both just look a lot bigger than the last time I saw them play up close. You know, these are two guys who, I don't want to say that they have similar skill sets, but they're attackmen who are fast and quick and have good sticks. So on that basis, the last time I saw both of them, I was like, yeah, they both are kind of skinny. And now that's not the case. They have filled out their frames. You know, for Evans, given that he's a year older and he's going to the gap between how strict the system that he plays in high school is relative to the system that he's going to play in at Providence is wider than it is for Kelly at Salisbury going to Notre Dame. You know, that transition is going to be interesting to follow for him. You know, with Kelly, my issue with him watching in his recruiting summer was that it was clear he had all the tools as a lefty, but that it didn't necessarily manifest in the production that you felt like it should have on the basis of the tools that he had. What was interesting watching him at this event was a combination of how it felt like he accepted his role. It wasn't as if he was trying to force it. He wasn't a ball hog. And Parker Reynolds really was the initiator of the offense. So Kelly found himself much more so in a attacking closeouts situation and in a throwing assist passes while the defense was moving type of situation. And I thought he was really productive. So it was good to see that, especially when you combined it with the athletic development that we saw. But again, with Reynolds, the thing that stood out to me the most, again, kind of power of suggestion, this was already in my brain. The prior weekend, I'd been talking to a handful of recruiters about how it felt like there's been this decline in shake relative to a reliance on speed in recent years. And I don't know whether that's something that everybody will agree with, but like I said, it just had it in my head that shake is a rarer commodity. Parker Reynolds has shake. His right-to-right split, he actually threw in a swim move. His willingness to funnel down the lefty alley or come back to his right and sweep over the top really stood out, and it made it hard for defenses to plan in terms of where they wanted to support from and everything that went along with that. And so he was the offensive MVP of the event because he scored either two or three straight goals in the fourth quarter to turn a tie game in the championship after three into what was a comfortable Salisbury win down the stretch. And the Princeton commit, like I said, is definitely one of the guys whose stock has risen the most. And then, you know, last thing I'll add is I was really impressed by Brock Geraci. You know, interesting recruiting story coming out of his junior year where he originally committed to Georgetown and then made the uncommon mid-year switch to North Carolina. His composure and his decision-making, his skill really stood out to me. And that's why I came away even more impressed by Jackson Allen than I might have been coming in, despite having already evaluated him twice at, you know, our ID event and then again at the when he was playing with IMG Academy at the event that I attended the third week in November in Florida last year. And his just sit, his posture, his cross check, and the way in which he was able to push Geraci to places on the field that it felt like he wanted to go all really impressed me. So check out the article that I wrote for InsideLacrosse.com. It's got 10 player evaluations, 20 players that I would give honorable mention to. And then the last guy that I haven't mentioned yet is Sam Whitehurst, who's kind of an attackman slash midfielder, probably a midfielder at Boston University. He went to Deerfield. He's going to do a PG year at Andover. And, you know, just he got the three asterisk treatment from me in the sense that every time I watched him, I thought he was making plays and I thought he was making good decisions. So, yeah, it was great to spend a Monday, Tuesday on a field at St. George's where you can legitimately see the beach from the sideline. And certainly given the heat wave that we didn't know at the time was coming, but we could have assumed was on its way because it always is, to have the ocean breeze was definitely a little bit of a reprieve after getting my first sunburn of the year at DE Turf on Saturday.
I'm right there with you. I got cooked at Showtime this week. I was like a roasting chicken sitting on the turf. One field.
See, one now field. I'm imagining so that scene from Seinfeld where Kramer turns into like a roasting
no chicken. Different.
So.
All right, Cap, bring it home. Let's talk about primetime and grade eight.
All right, let's start there. I guess we'll hit primetime first. Who was where which day?
I was at primetime on Saturday and grade eight on Sunday, and Dan was the opposite. And I think what that means is that when you're there on Saturday and it's pool play, you get a sense of a greater number of players, whereas when you go to an event on bracket play day, you get a sense of fewer players, but you get a deeper evaluation because you're seeing players, you know, in multiple halves as they advance from the quarters to the semis to the championship game.
And then, so Team 10 won it, talking grade eight. Team 10 wins it. What were your impressions of both the championship game, which was a 7-4 win over the Texas Stangs? What was your impression both of that championship game and the ultimate champions?
Well, it was really close through about three quarters, and then Team 10 pulled away down the stretch. And I would say that a couple of the guys that you've already mentioned stood out: Patrick Maloney, the short stick D-Mitty, Cole Carberry, the right-handed attackman who definitely was able to dodge off of the catch and attack defenses. But the two guys that stood out to me the most at the offensive end were Tyler Rutkowski, a lefty, who I think can play attack and midfield. He's from Shawnee, and he opened up the scoring with a low bouncer, a move that I love. He put his team up 3-2 with a cut through the middle, and then he scored again, flashing X from flashing lefty from X and finished low to low. But the other element was chemistry with Parker Smith, who I compared to Jay Carlson out loud and got a knowing nod from the recruiter that was sitting next to me. His ability to find space on the interior and really just release with snap from 8 to 10 yards. The type of shot that you don't need to shoot as hard and really more need to place. He chooses to shoot hard. And important that he got the ball on Cage, but especially so because Gabe James was the Stangs goalie, and I came away really impressed by him. But there are a couple other guys that deserve shout-outs. A lot of midfielders. The Stangs have a really deep group of midfielders. And so to run through, Bennett Hendricks, I think, would be the first guy that I would mention. He put his team up 2-1 with a really nice shot that hit the far pipe on a throwback from Spencer Mealy. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. A midi out of Pencrest, who is just a really like stocky player, really good on the rollback. And then two other guys, Josh Logan, Episcopal School of Dallas, had a really nice right to left swim, and then he swept into the alley and hammered a shot on the run to tie it 3-3. And then Alex Askaroglu, I think is how you're going to say that, Cy Fair, Texas, fast, and then had a really nice crossfield throwback after dodging down the alley. So it was a competitive game through three quarters, got a lot of good evaluations coming away from it, but ultimately I think I came away most impressed by Tyler Rockowitz and Maloney.
And Parker Smith, just to add, I have seen him a few times watching that Team 10 2025 team. He played with those guys last summer, at least for a chunk. And so he's kind of been on my radar for a bit, and partially because he was getting it done against the older group in those 2025s.
So I was at grade 8 on Saturday, so I got to see a lot of the pool play. And one thing I want to say about this event is it's really cool that just the amount of diversity in locations of the teams coming to this event. You know, we got to see teams from Texas, you know, True Illinois was there, Kings from Colorado was there. So I felt I really got a really holistic, you know, look at some of the players and teams that coming to this event. And I'll start, you know, with Texas because, you know, as Terry mentioned, there was lots of guys on Texas Mustangs, which is a Mad Dog affiliate, that really performed well. Two guys I want to give a shout-out to right away are 25's Gavin Reinhart, who's actually from Colorado, and then Jackson Bond, who plays for Highland Park in Texas. You know, Reinhart, not to throw out the comparison because we've already made this comparison early in the podcast, but Jake Bassano, and I think he's even, like, the same size. He's 5'9". He's a very compact, speedy LSM, does everything pretty much really well. But I think what draws people into his game is the fancy checks. He does the over-the-heads. He does the rusty gates. You can go look at his highlight tape, and it's all of that stuff. But it's so much more than that. It's so much more than the big, scary takeaways that it's going to demoralize teams. He's a game wrecker. You know, he's a guy who's going to make a play, whether that's on defense or in the middle of the field, that's just going to completely demoralize the other team. It can be the big check. It could be a goal. It could be a really clutch ground ball on a critical face-off. And I feel like he just was a guy who constantly just kept popping out. And then his teammate, his linemate, who actually plays close defense, Jackson Bond, you know, just like right where I was sitting, and I wish I had my camera for this, he just like does this perfectly timed slap check as the player is turning. The stick just goes flying helicopter style 6 feet into the air. It was one of the most impressive things I saw the whole weekend. It says he's 6'1", but I think he's bigger than that. I think he's grown a few inches since the rosters were updated. And he plays at Highland Park. His defensive coordinator is Matt Dunn, former defensive player of the year in the PLL. And it's just like, I was like, this kid's already really good. He's a 25. He's got one more year. Like, it's a little crazy to say that he doesn't have a home yet.
Jackson Bond?
This kid is going to be really good. Yeah.
Jackson Bond's a 26, buddy. He's even got more time than you realize.
Oh, man. I've got my notes wrong.
No, he's you're right on track, though. Everything you've said, at least about his game, feels 100% accurate. And to be able to invest in the fact that he's going to be coached by Matt Dunn for the next few years is right on point. On top of that, one of my favorite defenders in the 24 class is Ben Boyer. And so you know, obviously he's learning firsthand from him and Harrison Wheeler, who is another one of their best defenders at Highland Park. He's headed to Bucknell. But those guys, he's getting sculpted from, you know, some really impressive A players, B coaches. And you mentioned Matt Dunn, the head coach has some value also.
Yeah.
That's correct.
But yeah.
Who is the head coach for those that don't know?
That would be Coach Pressler.
Yeah, Mike Pressler.
But yeah, those two guys stuck out to me from Texas Stangs. And then I'm going a little long, but I'm going to shout out two other guys from 3D New England. One of them, who we've already mentioned this podcast, but Cooper Brosik. You know, clearly right away, without even looking at a roster, you could tell that this guy has a heavy background at box lacrosse, right? You know, Terry said that he kind of reminded him of Dyson Williams. I actually think he's a little bit more like Peyton Cormier. And I say that in the sense that he's going to score like a million goals wherever he goes to. He's going to find a way to score a million goals. But he's a big guy, 6'2", 170, he's listed at. He can dodge. He's got this really big stride to him. But, you know, as mentioned, the handles on this kid is just so impressive. And there was one moment in particular I'll shout out where, you know, he's dodging from X and he goes to cage with his right hand. Actually, take that back. He goes to his right, but the ball stays in his left hand or stays with his right hand is on the bottom of the stick. So I think he goes kind of like a little bit of a drag. And then I don't even know what he does, but he tries to do either an around the world or a behind the back. And it doesn't go in, but, you know, all the coaches I'm seeing are sort of like, whoa, what the heck was that? So, yeah, like this kid definitely popped off. You know, he was just a guy that a lot of people, I think, were talking about at the end of this weekend. But his teammate was also really impressive, and that's Jake Hiltz from Pingree School in Massachusetts. And, you know, I just wrote on my notes, it's like this kid is playing, it feels like he's playing on easy mode. You know, he, like the game I saw, he scored at least three of the first four goals. And luckily some guy got this on tape, but one of them was, you know, he just like jumps into the air and goes behind the back and just stings the bottom left-hand corner. And like one fluid motion, just so impressive. But, you know, so I like watched him a little bit more. I think his best asset, you know, he's an incredible finisher. He's fairly athletic, very skilled. But I think his best asset is his ability to find spots in the defense off ball, which is something that's really hard to evaluate in club ball because you don't have as much time as you do when you're with your high school team and you're practicing every single day for months on end. So that was something that was really impressive. Those 3D New England kids, they absolutely ran wild in the game that I saw. And so I wanted to give them a shout out.
Boom. Love it. All right, let's keep rolling here. You mentioned some of these teams from different areas. One team that I'm interested in, I haven't seen yet. They've always been, you know, really talented. That's the Sweet Lax team, the Sweet Lax Florida team, 2026s. Did either one of you guys get a good feel for them?
Yeah, I did. And, you know, one of the elements is Jackson Allen is on that team as well, but we've already talked about him a bunch, so I don't know that we necessarily need to go deeper on that. There are two Culver guys that stood out to me. Michael McColgan probably is the most substantial. He's just enormous, great athlete. There's just a ton of elements to his game. The guy that I was a little less familiar with that I came away more impressed by was James Whitehorse. They both go to Culver. Whitehorse is also really big. He had a nice right to left swim dodge when I was watching, a high to low shot. He really impressed me with he was playing point on extra man and he had a look away top down skip, which is, you know, one of my favorite kind of demonstrations of kind of having mastery of the game. And then the last guy I would mention is another midfielder, Brandon Williams, who goes to Salisbury. I didn't notice him in the Sweet Lex event or the MLA event that I was at, so I'm not sure whether or not he was there. But he definitely handled a lot of the initiation responsibility for that Sweet Lex 26's team.
All right, well, I feel like that's at least pretty good on grade 8. We have one more that we need to hit here. That's prime time. Dayburn, you had championship day. How'd you feel like that went? What went down? What'd you see? What'd you like?
Yeah, so I watched the 27, 26, 25 championships. I'll kind of focus on the 25s, I think, the most, because that was the one I felt like I had the most opportunity to really divulge a lot of the play. I thought it was also the most competitive. It was between Massachusetts Black and Primetime 2025s. And I think, you know, one of the takeaways I had from this event overall was that, wow, there's still a lot of really good uncommitted 2025s. And that was apparent not only in the two teams playing, but just all across the board from teams that I was watching throughout the day.
You mentioned a lot of those uncommitted 2025s. If you have a roster spot, just a single one to fill on Team Dan Abern, who would you be offering it to?
Yeah, so the guy that I definitely want to talk about is Drew Gannon. He played in the 2025 championship, plays for Massachusetts. He's from Belmont Hill. Just a really impactful LSM, you know. He had a big fourth quarter goal that kind of really said, hey, like, Massachusetts was in a position where it kind of felt like they were getting away, like the game was getting away from them. He had this really big goal in transition that kind of said, hey, like, we're putting an end to that run. You know, he's a playmaker, somebody who can be trusted with the ball in transition, off the face-off wing. He's there to get the scrappy GBs. And he's the team that he's playing on is loaded with kids going to, like, Notre Dame, the Ivies, you know, and I'm like, how is this kid uncommitted? He's clearly playing with great players. So I was a little surprised that he didn't have a home yet. If he keeps playing this, I think by the end of the summer, someone is going to get a really great, really great LSM. So he's the player I would shout out. But the interesting part of this 2025 championship was the fact that a 26 was the star of it, and that was Rick Giordano, a player that we've already mentioned. And for me, this is the player who I think whose stock has most dramatically risen, I think, this year, not just this summer. You know, I saw him play at the Hill Academy game earlier this year. He's first of all, he's a midfielder for Brunswick. He was a player who I didn't really have on my radar, and I've been to a lot of Brunswick games over the last 2 to 3 years, and he scores a hat trick against Hill Academy in dramatic fashion, and I'm like, okay, this kid is really good. And then you see him, you know, he's a standout at Best in Class, he's a standout at all these other events, and then he gets to this game, and he's a 26 playing up with the 2025s, and he's outstanding. He has two time and room goals in the first half that really kind of sets the tone for this game. And that's really what the scout is on this guy. Fantastic right-handed shooter. He definitely reminds me of Leo Hoffman, who also played at Brunswick, got some minutes for University of Pennsylvania this spring. I wouldn't be surprised if they have the same shooting coach, because it's a lot of the same mannerisms. But he also reminds me of Chris Gray in the sense that he's like this fire hydrant of a player. Like, not overly big, but very thick and explosive in his movements. But as I mentioned, like, he is just this kid who I think has really popped onto a lot of people's radars very quickly and very dramatically. And so he was probably the kid I came away most impressed with on Sunday, you know, playing up with the 25, scoring two really critical goals. And just, you know, just a player that Massachusetts was like, hey, like, we have to stop this guy. We have to account for this guy step down at any given moment. Which, if you know, like, the Prime Times is a stacked team. So for him to come out and have this performance, it really said a lot to me.
Yeah, all of that is really well said. Giordano, I think you mentioned just shooting off the, like, that's where it starts. That's the tip of the iceberg. He is a cannon. So you have to get out and play him. You have to play him out in range, and you have to fly out. And then after that, he's able to attack your approaches. He can score it on the run, and he can get to his left hand and let it fly on the run as well. So if you do have, like, a really heavy right-handed approach because you're worried about that step down that you're referring to, he's just going to split you off the other way, and you're toast anyways. So I love his game. He's been great. Terry, you were there Saturday. You had day one. Your day was a little bit more player-based than team or specific game-based. Who were some of the guys that you left there on Saturday most impressed with?
Yeah, I came home with notes on 53 players. there are six guys that I just want to quickly shout out because we've already talked about them on the podcast, but they were, you know, impressive, and I wouldn't be doing justice to talking about the event without mentioning them. So it's Garcia, who we already talked about, Kalala, Curry, Faison, and then Legas and Wyatt Stamness. That was the first time I'd seen him play. You already talked about him. I think the most efficient way to talk about some of the most substantial impressions I came away with were to talk about two units. It was actually, they were playing each other in the game that I watched, and I came away impressed by both. And it was the attack, and or maybe a little bit more broadly, the offense, because there are a couple of A/Ms for 91 Storm. So that's Tyler Burns, Massapequa, who's... dad is Timmy Burns from Syracuse, and then Devin Pacioni, whose dad was Dan, who was the assistant coach at St. John's for a really long time, and then the last one would be Nick Testa from St. Andrews, who is I thought all three of them were excellent in different ways. For me, Burns was really smart and hustled really hard. I thought Pacioni was really slick, quick, looks to feed first substantially. And then Testo was just kind of really skilled all around. And they were playing, I watched them play Cherries, who I thought was really good defensively. And from a projection to the next level standpoint, I thought there was one guy that rose above the others. And that is Bonner Upshaw from Detroit Country Day, just won a state championship in Michigan. And the term that I would use is Velociraptor. He's 6'5", lefty. When I first saw him, I was like, oh, he's really raw. But then as I watched him more closely, he's actually really composed footwork-wise in terms of his ability to guard the ball. So I think there's more work that needs to be done to his game in terms of off-ball awareness and being able to support, especially because he is so big and he would be able to utilize his frame both to eat space in passing lanes, but then also to hedge and turn back dodgers when he's not guarding players. But came away really impressed. That was probably the most useful half. I actually stayed for the full game because it was just, you know, really, I was getting a lot out of it. So really enjoyed that. Just kind of quickly ripping through some of the other guys that stood out to me. I'll stick with Cherries. I thought that Ryan Dye was really impressive for that team. Bouncing around a little bit from a short-to-short standpoint, I believe, I can't recall whether they lost in the semis or in the championship. I came away really impressed by Campbell Hogan from the Benjamin School in Florida. I thought he was really good at getting underneath on those S dodges from the wing and was able to kind of impose his will on opposing defenses. Primetime, loved what I saw out of Charlie Clark. He is a lefty, really savvy, high energy. Laxachusetts, Louis Mirabella is a defender who just kind of fits the mold of Laxachusetts defenders. He's out of Belmont Hill. He's a monster. DC Express, Cooper Keel, a player that we're pretty familiar with. He's just an athlete. Noah Rogers from Montclair, Kimberly Academy, playing for BBL. He looks to me like a ACC athlete. Along those lines, I thought Theodore Rudolph from Fairfield Prep, playing for Eclipse, also looked like an alpha. I was really impressed by him. And then I guess the last guy I'll mention is... Actually, no, they're... Okay, so I will shout out Henry Shoemaker, Mitty from Rye, playing for Predators. He's nasty. He plays with a mean streak. I don't know how athletic he is. He's just very good all around. Came away really impressed by him. And then two guys for Advance, a team that we've already talked about, and players that we've been familiar with. They've been on our radar for more than a year, but continue to do a lot. Tate Sedlacek from Marin Catholic. He's got a high-end frame, plays with a ton of composure, and can do everything. And then Tanner Ulrich, who plays for St. Ignatius. I was really impressed by his off-ball movement in this setting that I was watching him. And he had an excellent running bouncer. I've already mentioned how much I love that shot. And then the last guy would be Calvary's goalie, Dylan Siegel, from Fairfield Ward. So a lot of talent came away from it with, and really excited to get back out on the fields this weekend and come home with a lot more notes.
What is on your plate for this weekend?
Glad you asked, Dan. I am going to be heading to NHSLS on Friday, so as people are listening to this, and then heading to Crab Feast on Saturday before regrouping on Sunday. And the Inside Lacrosse staff is heading down to DE Turf for the Isle Women events, the Committed Experience and the ID Experience that we'll be hosting on Monday, Tuesday. And then we will we'll head back home. Well, some of us will. I probably am going to stick around and check out the Adrenaline Invitational. And some of us are going to head back home and get prepared for NHSLS that weekend, and then getting right back down to Delaware for NAL. And I know Kevin Brown, who's not on this podcast, is going to be at DE Turf this weekend for SWELAC Summer Showdown and their Summer Showcase on Friday preceding it. And then, Dan, I know you're going to be joining me in the area as well.
Absolutely.
That being Dan Ayburn. They're two
Dan's. Well, he is too.
The Dan and Dan podcast. No, yeah, I'm gonna be at Crab Feast on Sunday. I think, depending on, you know, I'm still in New York right now, but I'm gonna get down to the Mid Atlantic by Saturday morning. Maybe if there's an audible, I can call on Saturday and get out to NIHSLS, or maybe just come by for Crab Feast on Saturday as well. We'll see. But Crab Feast definitely on Sunday, and then yeah, I'll be at the women's events on Monday and Tuesday.
Coach Cap, you want to bring us home?
Yeah. All right. Does anybody have anything else they want to add? Final shout outs, events that they've been to, and players that they've seen that they just can't let this podcast go live without talking about.
It's been 90 minutes. So if there is somebody that we have not yet mentioned, I apologize and we'll get you next time. But no, no one has any additional shout outs.
All right. Well, with all of that said, thanks so much for tuning in to the Isle Preps to podcast. We will be back as soon as possible, hopefully next week, with another edition and breaking down more players that we've seen.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.